to this event celebrating the life, family, and adventures of Walter Harper, and recognizing the new book written by University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Mary Frank Erlander, Walter Harper, Alaska Native Son. I work with Mary at the university, and I have the honor of introducing her this evening. Mary is Director of Arctic and Northern Studies and Professor of History at UAF. In addition to Walter Harper's life, her research interests include an array of historical, political, and social issues in Alaska, including alcoholism, sexual violence, missionary influences, and oil politics. She is co-lead on the Model Arctic Council, a simulation designed to teach students about Arctic politics and governance. In 2016, she co-organized the first fully international Model Arctic Council at UAF. She teaches courses in Arctic and Northern Studies and in the Department of History. Her students absolutely rave about her classes, her kindness and gentleness, her availability and approachability, and overall words of wisdom. Just last year, she was recognized with the prestigious Usabelli Distinguished Teaching Award for her dedication to her students and for her work in the classroom. She received her BA in Political Science and MA in Northern Studies from UAF and MA and PhD in Government from the University of Virginia. Mary is the wife of Lars Erlander, playing accountant tonight, and proud mother of three sons, Stefan, Wyatt, Marcus, each of whom enjoys success in his respective career. I'm very proud to call Mary a friend and colleague. Thank you for coming this evening and participating in what will be an excellent panel on the life of an extraordinary Alaskan. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Brandon, for that very nice introduction. So I'm really honored to have such a large audience here, really tickled about this. And I'm so pleased and honored to have these four panelists here on the stage with me to my left. First, I have Johanna Harper, who's a childhood friend of mine. We went to Denali School, of all school names. And so I'm so pleased that she agreed to. Yes. I'm going for Denali, right? And then to her at left is her son, Dana Wright, and Johanna is the great niece of Walter, of course. And then her son, Dana Wright, is to her left. And he was a member of the Centennial Ascent team of Denali, which commemorated the 1913 Pioneer Ascent that Walter participated in. To his left is Sam Alexander, who is a colleague of mine at the university and who is from Fort Yukon and sort of represented Fort Yukon on that centennial climb as well. Fort Yukon was the home village of Johnny Fredson, who manned the base camp for the ascent team on the Pioneer, during the Pioneer ascent. And finally, we have Bishop Mark Lutin, the Episcopal Bishop of Alaska. And as I'm sure you all know, Episcopal Church history and Walter Harper's life intersect very, very closely. And so I'm so pleased to have him on the panel tonight too. So, before I offer some remarks about some highlights from Walter's life, I would like to recognize a few people here in the audience, and I'd like to stand to do that so I can really see you. First of all, I'd like to recognize Mike and Jane Harper. Mike is, where are you? There you are, Mike and Jane. Mike is a great nephew of Walter, and from the first time we talked about this book project, he was just so enthusiastic and supportive, and I just really appreciated that. Wally Carlo is over here to my left over here, and Wally is the chairman of the board of Doyon Limited, and he was so helpful to me because he read a manuscript of my book and gave me some very valuable feedback that was quite helpful to me. And Wally's family, the Carlo family, is related to the Harper family as well. And in front of Wally is his mother, Pauline Carlo, who's sitting here in front, so I'd like to recognize her too. We also have in the front row here, Diana Campbell, who is the granddaughter of Johnny Fredson, who again, who ran the base camp for the team. Also, we have here in the front row the Reverend Helen Peters, who is the pastor at St. James Episcopal Church in Tanana, which was Walter's hometown. We have the Reverend Scott Fisher, longtime pastor at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church over here on the left. And Shirley Gordon, whose husband, Bishop William Gordon, was the Bishop of Alaska from 1948 until 1974. And the Gordons were very dear friends of my parents, Con and Helen Frame. Also, is Chris Cannon here? Chris, are you here? Okay, well, I wanted to acknowledge him. He's a local mountaineer who's a student of mine and who gave me some good advice on the perils of being up high on the mountain and just how important human dynamics are up on the mountain. So I wanted to recognize him. I also want to recognize my dear husband, Lars, whom Brandon already mentioned. He has been so indulgent of my complete obsession with another man for the past 5 years. So I really want to thank him for that. And I also wanted to recognize my siblings who are here tonight, Randy and Georgianne Frank, Andrea Galvin, and Steve Frank. And my dean. I want to recognize my dean, Todd Sherman of the College of Liberal Arts, who's waving his fan back there. And then finally, I want to recognize someone who can't be here tonight. It's Terrence Cole, my dear friend and colleague and mentor, who has encouraged me in this project for such a long time, and he can't be here tonight because he's outside receiving medical care. But anyway, he's been very much in my thoughts in the last weeks, and so I wanted to recognize him too. Okay, well, with that, we'll go on and talk a little bit about Walter. Oops, that was the pointer. Okay, the six will get it. There. Okay, so Walter Harper was the eighth child of the legendary Arthur Harper and the Athabascan girl at the time, Sintana, who later was known as Jenny. Arthur and Jenny married in 1874 when she was 14 and he was 39. And Arthur Harper was really a legendary figure in Alaska and Yukon history because he was the man who was really credited with having been the first to recognize the gold potential of Alaska and the Yukon. So after Arthur and Jenny married, they moved about frequently over the next 20 years and living at trading posts that they established as gold was discovered at various places throughout Alaska's interior and even up into the Yukon. Their marriage produced 8 children, of which Walter was the youngest. Well, when Walter was about 2 years old, Jenny and Arthur separated, and Jenny returned to Tanana, where Walter was born, and she raised him there in the Athabascan tradition. And from a very young age, he exhibited just remarkable subsistence skills. Now, this wasn't altogether remarkable because he was allowed to roam freely through the wilderness, and that was the Athabascan way. And so, but he did seem to have quite a bit of natural talent for subsistence skills, and so became quite adept at a young age. When Walter was 16 years old, the Episcopal Archdeacon Hudson Stuck, who had arrived in Alaska in 1904, encountered Walter and his family at their summer fish camp. And he must have noticed something special about Walter because he talked Jenny into allowing him to take Walter to St. Mark's Mission at Nenana and go to school there. And so Jenny agreed, and Walter entered school there when he was 16 years old. He spoke hardly any English at the time, but after being there for just a short time, he showed great aptitude for school learning as well and progressed very nicely, while also impressing all the children at the school and the teachers too with his remarkable subsistence skills. So the following spring, When Hudson Stock came back, he noticed so much progress in Walter's development that he hired Walter to be his assistant and trail guide and riverboat pilot, and so that he would accompany Hudson Stock then on his travels throughout Alaska's interior. And so began an eight-year relationship between these two individuals that developed into quite a loving father-son relationship. This is the region that they traveled along the Yukon and its tributaries, the Tanana and the Koyukuk. And it's my, I'm convinced that as their relationship developed, their mutual faithfulness allowed them to develop into much stronger individuals with more talents and more abilities than either of them would have been able to accomplish on their own. In the end, Walter's most distinctive and remarkable traits were, first, his resourcefulness, both in terms of his just incredible subsistence skill set and his brilliance in all things mechanical, the social skills and charisma that allowed him to navigate comfortably in both his Athabascan culture and the Western culture of his birth father that he only learned to know through his through Hudson Stock, who became like a father figure to him. And finally, his sterling character. Hudson Stock said that the basis of Walter's character lay in an intense self-respect. As for Walter's faith, according to Stock, Harper was not religious in a formal or pretentious way. He lived his faith rather than proclaiming it. Walter's faith shone in his conscientiousness and in maintaining his self-respect, in his kindness and consideration of others, in resisting temptation, and in his honorable bearing. And all of these traits won Walter Harper admirers from all walks of life. So here we see them on the summer circuit on the river. There on your left, you see the pelican. And here's a picture of a rather young Walter with a little fox kit that he very naively thought that he could tame and carry along on the pelican. That didn't work out well. You could read more about that in the book, how that all ended, not very happily. Here we see Walter on the trail in the wintertime, having just felled a caribou. And what was really remarkable here was that as Hudson Stock helped him learn how to navigate within the Western culture, all the while, because he was on the trail and on the river in his homeland, he was continually honing his Athabascan skills at the same time. So in the end, as I mentioned, he was just so adept and navigated so comfortably between the two worlds. And as such, he was able to serve as a bridge between the two cultures. Wow. Let me just take a drink of water. So after 3 years on the trail, Hudson Stock's long-term dream of climbing Denali came to fruition. He had a team assembled to climb the mountain, which had not been summited yet. And here's the team right here. This is an image from his book, Ascent of Denali. You see his co-leader of the team, Harry Karstens, right there front and center. Walter is over on your far right. Next to Walter is Joni Fredson, who manned the base camp. To the left of Harry Karstens is Isaias George, another boy from St. Mark's Mission, who also helped, who was part of the support team for the ascent team. He returned to St. Mark's after they were already on the mountain. And finally, on the far left is Robert Tatum, who was a divinity student who was visiting up here. Later, he went to seminary school and became an Episcopal pastor. So I won't tell you about all the details of the climb. You can read about that in the book, but suffice it to say that Walter played a central role in the success of that expedition. And both Harry Carson's and Hudson Stuck agreed on that, and they didn't agree on too much, actually. But as Hudson Stuck wrote in his book, 21 years old and 6 feet tall, he took to high mountaineering, or took gleefully to high mountaineering, while his kindliness and invincible amiability endeared him to every member of the party. So yes, I'm no mountaineer. You can probably tell that just by looking at me. But all the evidence I found pointed to Walter's central role in the success of that team. Oh, and did I mention he was first to the summit? Okay. Well, so after the ascent, Walter and Hudson Stuck traveled out to Western Massachusetts, where Walter enrolled in the Mount Hermon School for Boys. And Mount Hermon was really quite a remarkable school at the time. It was a Christian-based school, and it differed from the Carlisle industrial schools of the time. Well, let me back up for a second. So by the time Walter entered the school in 1913, it had established quite a reputation for itself as a for having educated Native American students very well and preparing them for the professions, preparing them to return to their communities to fill leadership positions there. And that attitude differed quite starkly from the Carlisle-style industrial schools of the time that educated Native Americans for the industries, and which worked very, very energetically, shall we say, to assimilate Native Americans. They tended to denigrate Native American cultures and languages, and the Mount Hermon School didn't do that at all. It took quite a different approach in preparing Native Americans to return to their communities as leaders. So Hudson Stuck had developed a very warm impression of Mount Hermon because Arthur Wright, Walter's predecessor on the trail, had attended the school previously and spoke very highly of it. Here's a picture of Mount Hermon today, and here is a picture of Walter. Yeah.
I wonder why she's joking.
This is what my husband is.
Holy cow.
Okay, so, well, the school really was a wonderful school, but nevertheless, Walter never stopped being homesick for Fairbanks, but Interior Alaska while he was there. He did well in his studies, but he also struggled, never feeling quite at home and not having been entirely prepared after only really 3 years of somewhat formal schooling before going there. So after 3 years, Hudson Stuck brought him back to Alaska, where he once again thrived on the winter trail and on the summer circuit. Here they are at Allakaket in the spring of 1917. And then in the summer, early summer of 1917, a nurse from Philadelphia arrived at the mission in Fort Yukon, Frances Wells. And Frances Wells just took to Alaska like nothing you can really imagine. She loved Alaska, she loved her mission work, she loved the Athabascan people, and she fell in love with Walter Harper. That is not surprising. Now, Hudson Stuck wasn't too keen on this because in the meantime, Walter and Hudson Stuck had decided they had a plan for Walter's future, and he was gonna go back outside to school, to medical school, and he was going to go to medical school and become a physician, and then he wanted to return to his mother's homeland to serve the Athabascan people as a medical missionary. So that was his dream by this point, and Hudson Stuck didn't want anything to interfere with that. Well, Walter and Francis had other plans, so Stuck didn't get his way. Stuck and Harper made a final winter circuit together, and they started out in Fort Yukon over here, and they traveled, you can see yourselves. They traveled westward to the coast, out to Kotzebue. Then they traveled up north to Point Hope, where they spent 7 wonderful weeks with the Reverend William Thomas there, having such a great time. Then they traveled on up to Faro, where they spent 2 weeks among the Inupiat people there, hosted by the famous whaler Charles Brower. And then they continued their travels over past the demarcation point to Herschel Island over just inside Canada, where there was a Canadian mounted police outpost and an Episcopal mission or Anglican mission there. And then they began their journey home toward Fort Yukon in the springtime. And it was there on that final part of their journey that Walter confided in Hudson Stuck by handing him his diary he had been writing. He confided in him about his and Francis's plans to marry and about his own plans to join the Army Air Corps. Now, at first, Hudson Stuck was he wasn't really enthusiastic about that either, but he did come around to the idea. And after they returned to Fort Yukon, then Walter and Francis affirmed their plans to marry. They did, in fact, marry on September 4, 1918. Hudson Stuck married them in the chapel at Fort Yukon. And I like to think that this photograph was taken on their wedding day because Walter looks so happy. And after all, he's wearing a three-piece suit. So I'm thinking that may have been the special day. After they married, they went on this glorious three-week honeymoon, not doing the normal thing you would think of on a honeymoon. They spent the 3 weeks tramping through the wilderness and hunting so that Walter could supply the Episcopal mission at Fort Yukon with meat for the winter, because they were going outside, Walter to join the Air Corps and Francis to join the Red Cross and serve over there during the rest of the Great War. So they, after their three-week honeymoon, they boarded the Alaska, the steamer the Alaska, and traveled up the Yukon River to Whitehorse, where they took the railroad down to Skagway, and there they boarded the Princess Sophia. 2 days later, the ship foundered, and all 350-plus people aboard perished. And so thus ended the dreams of this young couple who were married but 7 weeks. Walter was 25 and Francis was 29. So normally biographies aren't written about people who only lived 25 years. But I found a lot of value in a tremendous amount of value in Walter's life story and thought that it needed to be told. And in the end, my editors at the University of Nebraska Press agreed with me. So these are the values that I find, the central values I find in Walter Harper's life story. It sheds light on an era when Western immigrants and culture inundated Alaska Native peoples and cultures, and the effects of new belief systems, products, habits, and diseases ranged from liberating to crushing. The story also illustrates Episcopal mission efforts to protect Native peoples from harm, even as they too introduce change. Walter's story illustrates the capacity for human interaction to maximize the individual's potential. And finally, his story, he exemplifies resilience in a young man whose physical, mental, and moral excellence reflected acculturation in both Athabascan and Western lifeways. So I just wanted to add one little point about this that I feel sort of compelled to say, and that is that it's about my relationship with Walter. So I am so honored to have come across Walter and to be able to tell his story. And I didn't ask him if I couldn't ask him if I could tell his story, but I'd like to think that I captured him fairly accurately. I do feel in the end that he would sort of wonder what all the fuss was about anyway. So with that, I'll turn it over to Johanna.
As Mary mentioned, Walter Harper was my great uncle. But I'm not the only one here who is a great niece or nephew. In addition to Mike Harper, who Mary introduced already, there's a few others here that I just want to take a minute to mention. The other nephews here tonight include Steve Blair and Jimmy Blair. I don't know if you can just raise your hand and wave a little bit. I don't know if either Eddie or Ron Harper are here, but they have come to other great nephews. Okay.
Can you hold the mics closer, please?
Okay. Great nieces that are here include Julie Anders, you can raise your hand too, Sue Cordelay, Diane Thomas, Ella Harper, and I don't know if Nikki is here or not. And of course, there's great grandnephew Dana Wright, who is here. There are two great nieces that we wanted to mention too, Phyllis Fast and Janet Harper Hayes, who could not be here tonight, but contributed a lot of information to Mary as she researched the book. And I also want to thank Mary for doing the book. She pulled together a massive amount of information from a multitude of sources and yet condensed it all down into an easy-to-read chronology about Walter's life. I don't think anybody could have done a better job than she did. As you read the book, you can't help but wonder what kind of influence Walter would have had if he had lived. She talks about how Walter was the youngest of eight children, and his father, Arthur, sent the older children out to boarding school when they were 6 or 7 years old, even though their mother, Jenny, objected. But when Walter was a couple years old, Jenny and Arthur divorced, and so Walter didn't have that chance. He didn't get that education. And Mary and I have briefly discussed how interesting it is that these different turning points in Walter's life actually worked out to his advantage. Even though he didn't have that education, he was learning something more valuable, the traditional Athabasca lifestyle. Like Mary said, Walter was 16 when Hudson Stuck met him. That was at fish camp, and at that point, Walter didn't speak English, and he couldn't read or write. But Hudson Stuck saw potential and convinced Jenny that Walter would benefit from attending school at St. Mark's Mission in Nanana. And he did. He excelled there. And that brings out one of Walter's personality traits, a positive attitude. And it comes out to me because he didn't let his late start in education diminish his zeal for learning. He just pushed right on through and learned, and also earned the respect of his fellow Native students because of his subsistence skills. So to me, those two attributes mark a potentially great leader. St. Mark's Mission was just one of Hudson Stuck's missions. He, like Mary showed on her map, he was in charge of a huge territory. And Alaska was facing challenges at that time. There was infectious diseases, social ills such as alcohol abuse. And Stuck believed that only the church could save Alaska's Native people, and it would be by shaping the Native leaders of tomorrow. And to that end, St. Mark's Mission and the other missions took that challenge, and they taught their Native students the habit of hard work and values such as honesty, respect, and religious service. And again, you wonder, what if Walter didn't go to St. Mark's? What if he had stayed with his family and worked alongside his brothers, who at that point were chopping wood to fuel the steamers along the Yukon? What if he had gone into trading or prospecting? It's just fortunate, it seems like, that he ended up at St. Mark's Mission, where values such as honesty and respect were at the forefront. Another thing that he learned in his travels with Hudson Stuck, Mary mentioned that at Hudson Stuck selected him at St. Mark's Mission to be his riverboat pilot, trail guide, and interpreter. And they traveled the river. Hudson Stuck tutored Walter, but he also met a wide variety of people. He met civic leaders and the old timers who were living in the camps, plus the native elders in the community. So all of these adventures that he took, it would have added to his ability to lead people later on. Another thing that happened on the river was Hudson Stuck learned about a smallpox outbreak. He contacted the church, and the church immediately saw to it that vaccines were provided to the missions. And with a doctor on board, Hudson Stuck and Walter traveled the Yukon and provided immunizations to every camp, every village. So Walter got to witness firsthand there how effective it is when people pull together to accomplish a single goal. The same held true with Mount Hermon when Walter went to learn there. That school was focused on making future leaders as well. And Walter wasn't the only one who got to go to St. Hermon, like Mary said. Arthur Wright before him got to attend, and after him, Johnny Fredson did. And Johnny Fredson was on the climb, and I just have to admire how at a young age he held down that base camp and waited for everybody to come back, not knowing what was going on because they didn't come back when they said they would. Johnny Fredson went on to become a great leader. And I know that there's people here in the audience, and hopefully they'll relate a little bit about him later. Another student that got to participate was Moses Cruikshank. And I met Moses at Doyle Limited. He was a shareholder, and he used to come in and visit us. And he was soft-spoken, and even though he was soft-spoken, he had a very commanding presence. And I wondered if Walter wouldn't have been just like that. Mary mentioned that when Walter and Hudson Stuck traveled on the Arctic Circuit, they stopped in Barrow and they visited with Charlie Brower. And Charlie Brower was very interested in getting news about the Great War, because in Charlie's words, his own sons were over there. And this partially spurred Walter on. He wanted to serve as well. And it's a desire for that service that led him and his young bride to be on the Princess Sophia when it sank in Alaska's greatest maritime disaster just 99 years ago today. Mm-hmm. So with all those leadership traits that I mentioned, and when you read Mary's book, there's a whole bunch of more anecdotes about how Walter displayed leadership skills. You can't help but let your imagination run wild with his potential leadership. And with that, I'll turn it over to his great grandnephew, Dana Wright.
Hi, everybody. I'm a walker and a talker. So. Gonna come down here. My name is Dana Wright, lifelong Alaskan. This wonderful woman right here is my mother, Johanna Harper. Walter Harper was my great grand uncle. He never had any kids. I'm very proud of him. I'm very proud to be related to him. Feel like I automatically have some credibility just existing, which is kind of interesting. I think one of Walter's most notable accomplishments was being the first man to summit Denali in 1913. That was something that was widely credited to Hudson Stuck, to Stuck's advantage, or to his credit. He organized everything. But it was, Walter Harper was a shining example of just being a workhorse and being someone very agreeable on the mountain. I can speak from a little bit of experience being on the north side of Denali, on the Muldrow Glacier, that one of the most important things is playing nice with your teammates, because you're up there for a long time, you're in a tent, you're very confined spaces, and you can't make it up alone. So you really have to you have to play your part. And I think Walter did an excellent job of that. And I think he was the glue that held that whole trip together. I was lucky enough to be at the right spot at the right time and the right health. When 2013 rolled around, I was representing Walter Harper in the Denali 2013 expedition. Sam was also on that. It was really fun. So descendants of the original climbing team all got together and retraced the same route about the same time as the original. The difference was we didn't start in March by dog sled. We have real jobs. Let's get back to them. So we started from Wonder Lake, which is at the end of the Denali National Park Road. Got out of a bus and took off into the wilderness, just like they did crossing the McKinley River and making our way up. It was a 27-day trip. 21 days up, 5 days back down. So a big portion of the Denali 2013 climb or the agenda was to celebrate. I mean, it was a historical deal. We wanted to pay tribute to the original climbing team. Another big part of that was we wanted to give credit to Walter Harper, who was largely unknown as the first person to summit. So we wanted to give credit where credit was due. Representing Walter Harper, maybe that was just my opinion of the reason. And the other big thing that we were pushing for at that time was to get the name changed from Mount McKinley back to Denali. That was a big thing that we were pushing for and trying to raise awareness of. With the 100-year anniversary of the first ascent, we were hoping maybe we could tip the scales and start a conversation. I was lucky enough to speak with Sam Alexander, Ken Carson's, a few years ago, and shortly thereafter, we did it. Denali was changed back, which was an amazing feat, so I'm very happy about that. So I am by no means a historian. I've been enlisted on this panel for my firsthand experience being on the north side of Denali, doing the original route as they did in 1913. And I want to just kind of bring a visual representation and a short run through of our trip. The original climbing trip was full of a lot of back and forth and a lot of disasters and a lot of unforeseen circumstances, from avalanches that really damaged the trails to their tent catching on fire, high up the mountain, just countless deals. You have to read the book for that. But I wanted to give a rundown of our trip. So what you can see right here is this flag right here was our Centennial Climb flag. They're pretty neat. We all have them and they're all signed. And then this big old ice axe right here is actually a replica that was made by the Parsons family. There was six made, I believe. Replica of the exact ice axe that they used on the original climb. Somehow I got suckered into being the guy that carried one of those ice axes all the way up to the top. It seemed like a good idea at the time. It probably stands about this tall from a mountaineering perspective. In modern mountaineering, completely ineffective. But it made for a good story. So we have the Denali 2013 Centennial Climbing Crew. Just kind of wanted to show, this is day one, right as we were getting started. You can't necessarily see everybody because of the soul-crushing weight on their backs, but I want to give you a quick rundown of everybody that participated. We have our guides on the end. So we have Dustin English right here and Hunter Dahlberg. They were the main guides on the trip. We also have Elliot Gaddy and Paige Brady. Little side note, they fell in love on this trip. I'm just holding together today. So, you know, thanks to us. you'll see, starting over here, we have Sam Tatum,
Sam Alexander, that's myself in the middle. Ken Karstens, who is a major resource for anything history regarding Alaska, anything. He knows all about it. And I got a great history lesson. He was my tent mate on the way up. he knows so much. It's incredible that the amount of things this guy can just spout out right off the top of his head. This is his cousin, Ray. So myself, Ken, and Ray were all in a tent. We shared a tent together. And then we have Dan Hopkins, who was a great-grandson, I believe, of Hudson Stump. So we had, we had people from all the original climbing teams, and we got dropped off. And this is right in front of the McKinley River right here, which is not fun to cross first thing as you start the trip. We all had about somewhere between 80 and 90 pounds on our back, and we had to carry the sleds that we used to haul our weight up the rest of the way to go in there. So the first couple days were very rough. This is the first camp, and you can see the valley way back there. So our guide, lead guide Hunter, we were sitting and making dinner, and I was like, wow, that's really beautiful. He's like, it's really better if it's cloudy outside, because then you don't know how far you have to walk. You can just kind of deny it. So first day went well because we had to hike all of 2 miles on flat ground. It was quite nice, and have our first night together, and then we began heading off across the McKinley River, went towards Turtle Hill, and then followed Cache Creek all the way up to McGonigal Pass. McGonigal Pass gets you to the Muldrow Glacier, which is basically the staircase to get up to the upper portion of the mountain. So this is the team hanging out as we got onto the Muldrow Glacier. We are below the lower ice fall. There's several steps of ice fall on the glacier where you can see how broken up the glacier is. We had to find our way through these or go around them the whole time. It's very dangerous that you have to be roped together all the time because snow will bridge over these crevasses, which are the big cracks in the glacier. And it looks fine and it looks nice and steady until you put a foot on it, and all of a sudden there's no ground below that. I think just about everybody fell into one crevasse on the way, whether it's just up to your waist to all the way in. Poor Ken Karstens fell in, I think, about 5 or 6 times. I started calling him the crack finder on the way up. We were particularly blessed on this trip because the sun just, it worked with us. I felt like it was just really working to our advantage the whole time. The weather was pretty nice as far as a Denali trip goes. I don't have many stories about how cold it was at night and the terrible blizzards. It was actually pretty sunny and beautiful for the most part, so we had it pretty easy. Moving up to the top of the Muldrow Glacier, this is when it got real, I guess you could say. So what you can see here is the Harper Ice Bowl, which is the base of the Harper Glacier. That feeds the Muldrow Glacier, which is the largest glacier in Alaska, if I understand it correctly, or in that range. We also have Karstens Ridge, which is this ridge right up here. This was named after Harry Karstens for his hard work, and this was the crux of the 1913 climb. There was a big earthquake that had just shattered that whole ridge to pieces, where it once was a nice ridge on previous expeditions attempting the summit. At this point, it was all broken apart. So they spent about 3 weeks on that area. It felt like we spent 3 weeks on that area, just a couple days. Brown's Tower, it's about 4,000 vertical feet, which is almost a mile. This is almost a vertical mile, just right here. For reference, we're a ways away from here. So this is where the general hiking up a mountain and actually climbing up a mountain kind of took shape. I just love this photo. So this is the family namesake right here, and this ice fall, I mean, it was constantly calving, and we would be, on a rest day, or if we were to stop, you would just hear just loud booming but it wasn't, didn't sound close by. It just kind of, you know, you just heard it in the air and eventually just got used to it. But it was very unsettling for a long time. And so we had to obviously get beside this ice fall and get up to the top of the upper mountain. So this is us on Carson's Ridge. Got a little photo right here of, for a reference, kind of how steep it was. There's a lot of areas we had to climb around, and it's very steep and not particularly fun when you have a heavy backpack on. You'll also see over here, this is on our way up the ridge, and you can see the Muldrow Glacier down there. Our camp is basically some little black dots back down there. On the way up, I stopped and just took a photo because, well, maybe I should have been focusing on mountaineering at that moment, but you can kind of see the extent of where we were climbing, how it just drops down on either side. It was about 2,000 feet down to our right looking up to the Muldrow Glacier, and about 5,000 feet down on the other side to the Tri-Lake Glacier. So this was the there's no room for error part of the climb. And it was really interesting. It was incredible views. I mean, just amazing views. Some of the best that of the whole trip, I would say. And it was really hard to appreciate because you're just terrified the whole time. Summit day. This was a tough one. You can see the size of that ice axe compared to a normal mountaineering ice axe. I was really over that thing at this point. Really over it. Through the whole time, everyone's like, we'll help you carry it, we'll help you carry it. And every morning got up, everyone's like, all right, let's go. So I'm over here on the left, Ken in the middle, Sam right here, and Dan. We were the ones that made it. Unfortunately, Sam Tatum had really bad blisters on the trip. He had to turn around. That sounds kind of like a lame reason to stop, but if you'd seen his feet, you'd call him a trooper. And poor Ray got altitude sickness at the end, and it was not his want to not come up on the final day. He was actually told by the guiding company, you cannot. So he was pretty upset that day, but he took it in stride. I wrote down 14-hour day, and I don't remember if that's accurate. It felt like 24 or 48 hours on this trip. As you're up at that height, every step, you have to catch your breath, take another step, catch your breath, move another step, and then with that breath, you ask when you can take the next break. So Denali was at 20,320 feet. It has been reclassified at 20,310 feet. I'm going with 20. It's the highest elevation in all of North America. It's also considered the highest elevation gain climb in the world, 18,000 feet. So it is, it's long. So we had the four climbers and three guys that went up. At this point, all I could think about, not my loved ones, not my girlfriend at the time, bacon cheeseburgers. I had been eating couscous and rice and oatmeal, and I could eat half my body weight in a day. And all I could think about was how I was just going to destroy anything that was edible until Keaton when I got back. But we were still at the top of Denali and had to make our way all the way back. Luckily, on the way back down, as you go into thicker air, as you're losing elevation, you gain strength and you gain stamina, and you're walking downhill. So we get down a lot faster than we got up. That does not make it easy. It's actually much more dangerous on the way down. Gravity is taking you down, so if you make a misstep, which several of us did, it could be pretty bad. So on our way down, this is one of my favorite photos of the entire trip. What I really like about this photo is, visually, it's great, but this day was about 2 days after our summit day, and we woke up just dog tired. We got up to high camp, we rested, we had a weather window, and had to go up the very next day to summit, and then back down, and then back down, and back down, and woke up in the morning, and a new alpine starts, which is, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. and it's raining. Mm-hmm. And everybody's tired, and we're hearing rock slides going down either side of the glacier, which we're going to have to walk on the side of the glacier to get out. We're hearing, you know, hearing all this stuff going on. It's raining. No one wants to get up. Everybody's just struggling. And the guides are pretty much at this point like, get out of the tent. Nobody wants to. Finally, begrudgingly get out and get suited up and get on the trail. And there was a lot of forest fires in the interior during this time. So what you're seeing right here is actually a lot of smoke at the bottom and then clouds up top. And as we were walking down, the sun pops up and just lights up the whole valley. During this time, you can see a lot of little cracks in the glacier right here. So these are things you need to be watching for. And I was looking down, trying to take photos, looking down, trying to take some more photos. And this is one of my favorite photos of the climb, just because it kind of signified a little bit of hope. It signified, like, you know, you can get there, you can make it back, keep on walking. Those bacon cheeseburgers ain't gonna come to you. So this is what the glacier looked like on our way out. So on the way there, everything was white and covered with snow. And you realize how many crevasses you walked over during that time. So as we got to this part of the glacier, there was no more roping up at all. If you fall in a crevasse, you take everyone else out with you. If you can't see one of these before you walk into it, maybe you shouldn't be on the mountain in the first place. So this was on the way out. This is 2 days before we made our final way out. And then the home stretch was crossing the McKinley River. This is kind of the crux of the whole climb. You're tired. And at this point in the summer, the river was pretty high. It got up to our waist, and when you have a heavy pack on, this river can take you out and wash you away. So we had some good numb legs by the time we got out of here. It wasn't just you couldn't feel your feet, it was you couldn't feel your knees or your, you know, lower thighs. They just completely numb. The drive for bacon cheeseburgers. So the beautiful thing is, once we got to the other side of this, we were lucky enough to have some cinnamon rolls, which were provided for us. And then Diana was there at the bus pickup with, I guess, signifying I suppose you kept the sugar for us the whole time. So she brought a bunch of refreshments for us, and Johnny Fresden had saved sugar for the original climbing team as he was watching base camp. And they said, you know, here's some sugar for you, use it as you please. He saved it for a month for when they got back, and they all praised him for his patience and all that. And so she came back with some ceremonial sugar for us. More importantly, some caribou meat and some beer, which was very, very well earned. And then we hopped on a bus and headed back to civilization. So it was a long time, and during that time, I really felt like I was there to represent Walter. And there's a lot of family pride in there, and I really wanted to make sure that I was not embarrassing myself or the family name or Walter Harper's legacy during this whole time. So in times where I would have just, you know, given somebody a piece of my mind, I'm like, you're here to represent, just be nice, play a part, do what you gotta do. And it was great. It was an amazing time. I'm super thankful for the opportunity. It was life-changing. I didn't realize what it would be or how it would affect my life, but it's been a very positive impact, and I feel as though I identify with Walter a lot more through this, and I feel like I've got to know him. It's pretty amazing, and reading the book has really kind of set the stage and set the story so much more for me, and really got a lot of history that I was not aware of, and I guess I should be, considering it's my family story. So thank you for that. It was really amazing. With that, I'm going to hand it off to Sam Alexander. Thank you.
So I'll be honest, it wasn't wasn't for me, Dana would never made it to the top. That being noted. Okay, it was an incredible climb. It was an incredible experience. And for me, you know, I was asked to come here tonight and be a part of this. And, you know, thinking back to that time, the climb for us in 2013, the story began much earlier than that, though. The story began much earlier than that. I grew up in Fort Yukon. That's where Hudson Stuck is buried. And so growing up, you hear stories about Hudson Stuck, and you know people who were born in Stuck Memorial Hospital. My grandmother worked there. That's where a lot of my family was born. And there are so many stories shared about the impact that this one man had. So it was, you know, it's incredible to look back at that legacy he left and recognize that it's still alive today. And I think one of the things that, you know, this book has really made me aware of is that the story of Walter has never really been told so well. Growing up in Fort Yukon, you hear about John Fredson. And so for the Gwich'in people, you know, Gwich'in, and that's kind of like our George Washington, right? This guy's like Leonardo da Vinci, George Washington, all these people rolled up into one because he was so incredible. And as was said earlier, I wonder what the legacy of Walter Harper would have been, you know, had, you know, the accident hadn't occurred. And so thinking about that and reading the book and knowing the history now, I feel that it's so wonderful that we can share the incredible life of Walter Harper because of the inspiration that he really was. And I do think it's unfortunate that it's only now that this story is finally being told. Raise your hand if you, just to give you a little background, I teach at the university, and so I do walking down, up and down the aisles, and it's because mainly I'm looking for people sleeping. And I can take a look at this crowd here, and I know it's probably past our bedtimes. So, all right, I'm looking at you. But no, for real, raise your hand if you actually knew about Walter Harper before this. All right? We've got quite a few, and that's impressive. That's impressive, and that's what I like to see. And what I'd like to see as an educator, teaching at the university, is I like to see, you know, the younger generations learning about Walter Harper, because I can tell you, such an inspiration to me. You know, my mother, she's white. My father's Gwich'in. I grew up in a small village. And like Walter Harper, I left to go down to the States to go to school and struggled. It was an absolute struggle. My brother Ed here, and he could tell you about that, tell you some stories. But it's absolute struggle, and you know, we had very few role models to look up to in terms of somebody that could actually bridge the divide and live in both worlds. Very few. John Fredson, thank God for him, was one of them. You know, Jock Batson, Wolf Smeller, he was able to do it. He lived such an incredible life. And from the time he graduated from college in the University of South in Suwannee, Tennessee, it had been decades since the next Gwich'in person graduated from college. Decades. So who are we to look at? Who are we to look at? And now we have somebody we finally recognize, which is Walter Harper. There's another person for us to look at. And especially in the sense that you think about Alaska, you think about our history, Walter Harper really represented the kind of the future of the state of Alaska. He represented the future. He was a man that could bridge the divide. And as a Native community, that was something we desperately needed, was a man that could bridge the divide, a woman that could bridge the divide. We needed that person like him as a leader. It's you know, taking a long time, but we're getting there now. Now at the university, one of the things I teach is a leadership class. And so I'm not going to give you any Tony Robbins style leadership lecture here. I'm going to keep it low key. But what I'd like to really point out is that you can't really have a person like Walter Harper without having a person like Hudson Stuck. You can't have that. That mentorship that Hudson Stuck provided was absolutely critical. And I really just am amazed at the progressive nature and values that Hudson Stuck had when it came to education. Hudson Stuck said that he would rather have a Native person be educated in the Native ways than for a young Native person to be educated in the non-Native ways and lay around the village and do nothing. Because he recognized that value of the Native education. He didn't push, you know, the Western ways on the people that he worked with. He didn't do that at all. He recognized the value of traditional knowledge. And you think about it, we're just now in this state getting to that point where we recognize the value of traditional knowledge. You know, Alaska Native languages were only just recently recognized as official languages in this state. Think about that. It's been 100 years since these guys, you know, climbed the mountain. We just got the name changed in 2015. They climbed that mountain in 1913. You think about how long that is. And so you think about Hudson Stuck and the impact that he had on Walter Harper to have that type of education that he supported. He never pulled him out in the sense that he didn't want him to have that Native education. He supported Native education, and he also supported this, you know, strong liberal arts education. He also supported, you know, Walter being on the land. And that's an incredible thing. Now, I will tell you, as somebody that grew up in both worlds, you know, I was traveling one day. I was down in Haines. I was visiting some friends down there, and I saw this young woman. She was a Tlingit weaver, and we were talking. And I said, you know, how do you do it? How did you learn? And like, tell me about what, you know, your life here. And she's telling me about growing up and learning weaving. And she said, you know, it's tough. And I said, what's that? And she said, you know, we're expected to be Native and expected to be knowledgeable in the Western world, but there's only 24 hours in a day. Right? There's only 24 hours in a day. And so I think it's very much a testament to Walter Harper and Hudson Stuck that Walter Harper was able to be at the peak, literally, really, in both worlds. And so that's one of the things that I'm, you know, very inspired by. So thank you for the great book, and thank you for having me here.
Well, thank you. Hudson Stuck, one of my favorite quotations from Stuck is, he spoke about the ruthless arrogance of people who would come into a land and have total disregard for the names and places where people have been living all their lives. He used that phrase, ruthless arrogance, when he discussed how what an abomination it was that Denali had been renamed to McKinley. And I know that that was one of the things that certainly motivated him for wanting to summit that mountain. And I think it was also, in part, his dream that Walter would have been the first person to reach the top. And I just would share with you this evening that this afternoon, for I think the 20th year in a row, and it may be longer than that, a service of memorial was held in Juneau at the cemetery at the graveside of Walter and Frances. The Episcopal Church is there in Juneau treasure the story of Walter and Frances and feel a real affinity to that story and try to remember it every year. So that's important, and I know you mentioned that, Johanna, that it was 99 years ago on this very day that the Princess Sophia wandered and their lives were lost. What I'm proud of about Walter Harper's story is, in fact, how it reveals so many stories of strength and resilience in Alaska, particularly amongst our Native folks. But also the one of the names that Mary's book mentions, along with Hudson Stuck, is Annie Farthing. There are so many incredible women who were part of the story of Walter Harper and Hudson Stuck, and frankly, I think Scott Fisher maybe told me once that if there was only one person in the world that Hudson Stuck was afraid of, it was Annie Farthing. I don't know if that's, I think you told me that one time. But as you read Stuck's books about his travels with Walter, you do encounter some extraordinary people who really were dedicated to making sure that Native tradition, Native life, and their health as a people wasn't lost as the culture and the land was sort of changing with contact with the Western world. The other thing I think I find amazing about Walter and his personality is we do talk an awful lot about Stuck in the church, and certainly it sounds as if he had a personality that was larger than life. I have a 16-year-old, and I have a 23-year-old, and I'm just amazed that Walter didn't leave Stuck out there on one of those trails at some point. And I also can relate to that last circuit where, you know, you wait until you're in the final home stretch. I've had the joy of traveling with my 16-year-old going around doing visitations. And he does have the good sense to wait until we're about 30 minutes from home before he says, "Hey, Dad, there's something I want to tell you. I've been thinking." Like Walter did, I'm sure, when he sprung it on Hudson Stuck that he was going to marry Francis and change his directions. But I was very pleased, and thank you, Mary, for this book. I was very pleased to read about what I think is one of the strengths of the Episcopal Church here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. That it was its dedication to culture, the culture of the Native folks, and maintaining language. The prayer book of the Anglican tradition, the Episcopal Church, was translated into Kuchin, into Tagalog, and into the Koyukon languages, and in Point Hope. And I would be grateful to see that you mentioned that English, or that Inupiaq was spoken in the mission school in Point Hope, which was an Episcopal school, right up until the end of the 1919. Because our church really felt that it was important that the language be preserved. And we're continuing that. We're working on doing translations in the Western preaching. So the only other thing I would say is that I had the joy of preparing to do the Denali climb with the group up until about 4 or 5 weeks before the climb. I was actually planning on being on one of those ropes going up that mountain. And then we discovered Sam Tatum, so that we would have a representative of the Tatum family. And by then, the plans were so far in place that it made no sense for us to try and add somebody. Somebody could just simply give up his spot on the rope for Sam. And as I look at those pictures, and as I hear Sam and Dana talk about the trip, I have never been so grateful like Sam Tatum in all my life. What in the world was I thinking? That was scary stuff. So I'm pleased to have been asked to be part of this panel, and I'm really cherish the memory of Walter, and it is wonderful to think about the influence that he had, even in his short years, throughout the interior. And I'm just grateful for his memory and for this book.
So thank you all. This has been just beyond my expectation. Well, not that I didn't have high expectations. Let's just say, you totally met my expectations. You did a fabulous job. So thank you so much for that. I wanted to, I forgot to mention that one of the things that we had hoped to do tonight was to add to the quite extensive Harper family tree that the Harper family already has created, but it has a lot of gaps in it. It turns out that was too difficult to do here today because it's so long and I couldn't really figure it out logistically. But what we would like to ask you to do is Mike Harper has, who's sitting up here in the front, he has some 3x5 cards. And so we are going to follow this with a Q&A session, but I just wanted to remember right now to tell you that if you have a connection to this story that you'd like to share with the family, or if you are related to the Harper family, either closely or distantly, the family would love to hear about that, and I would love to hear about that. So Mike has cards, and so if you can just kind of look for him when we get up and mill around, that would be great. At this point, I'd like to open it up to questions from you, and they don't have to be questions either. If you'd like to tell how you feel connected with this story, we would love to hear from you too. We're also open to questions. And I meant to ask one of my students to be a runner with the microphone tonight. Is there, but I forgot to do that. So is there
I'll
somebody, one of my students?
Okay.
Diana
will
do that. Please
get paid
to do this.
Oh, okay.
Great.
And it
will be this one.
Okay. Could I just say, I wrote some notes down because when I was listening, I had to say, and when Johanna started describing Walter, she almost was using the same words that I've heard described about Johnny, and the same words that you were describing about Arthur Wright and Moses Cruikshank. They were all those very intelligent, kind, patient people, and I think it had more to do with being Alaska Native than anything. It was just something that they had learned early on to be that way, that they were respectful and patient and humble. I've seen that a lot in Alaska Native men. And then hearing it, he just kind of connected some more dots for me. I have to agree with Sam too. Hudson Stuck, that guy was phenomenal. And I got to visit Suwannee University, where my grandfather went to school and graduated with a degree, a Bachelor of Science degree. And I didn't realize what a big name he was in the Episcopal University until I went to the chapel and started looking at all the memorial they would have in memorial tiles for people who had passed on. And they were all maybe 3x5 until I got to Hudson Stuck. It was like two feet by 4 feet. So I was, he was a pretty big deal. But he was really way ahead of his time, way ahead of his time. And I have to say something about walking in two worlds. It's really hard. Yeah, and I think whenever I learn about my grandfather's story, whenever I learn something more, it is one of the most difficult things, I think, to call upon a human being to do, is be adaptive to two different cultures daily. It's very difficult. And I think in my grandfather's life, it was difficult. And I am sure it was for Walter and the others, and Sam, even for us today. And then the other thing I wanted to tell you, I don't know if you know this or not, but the Pelican II, the Episcopal boat, or the Pelican was the first one that Hudson Stuck had. It was the first boat that the Riverboat Discovery people used. They went way back then, that they would take people out when they first started, and it's actually on the banks of the Chena River. I did a story about the Chena River, but looking at it from going on the Chena River instead of the point of view of looking at it while I was standing on the shore, and I got to see the Pelican, and then I kind of got geeky. And the other thing I wanted to say was the time that you wrote about, and the time of Hudson Stuck and Johnny Fredson and the Gold Rush, the people who lived in Alaska at that time were really, really probably defined by the land more than we even are now. And this was a difficult, I mean, to understand what we're talking about now, what these amazing people did, you have to understand it was the land, I think, that really formed them. I don't know. I could challenge you on that. But anyway, anybody? That's all I have. Anybody have a question?
Thank you.
not a question, but I just want to point out, Walter Harper has been honored by the Harper Building at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which is on Geist Road, and also in the Westmark Hotel, there's a fine little dining room that's sort of a conference room. It's called the Harper Room, and it's right next to where the Red Lantern is, but it's right, that room is a very fine conference room. I just thought I'd point out that people hadn't noticed these two things are named after Walter Harper.
Thank you for that. I was just going to point out that the Harper Building on the University of Alaska is actually named for his niece, Flora Jane Harper. She was the first Alaska Native to graduate, so that's where that name came from. But I thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, panel. That is such a great book, and all the work that you put into it. Since I've read the book and the manuscript, I do a lot of talking to some of our students, elementary, university students, leadership classes. But no, since you've written this book, I'm using that book as a motivation. What a young person can do, planning through goals and objectives, and knowing two worlds, Western and your Athabasca race. And I think about your photo going up that ridge. One side is the Western way. The other side is our Indian way. We have people that are so intelligent from that side. So intelligent. All different levels of our Athabascan ways. So I always let them know, you don't forget them. Our family came up from the villages in 57. We came into Fairbanks. But there was a hole in my heart, really. I needed to know that other side, so I went back and to try to fill some of that. But so rich. Anyway, I want to thank you so much. I know Tanana, Walter was from Tanana. His mother was Jenny Albert. And they have a song about Denali, Tanana does. And just when the president officially gave the name back, Denali, my mother was there, and she created a song named Denali. So, I mean, I'm sure if you asked her, she'd probably sing it.
Over 60 years.
You got
close to you. Okay, I have been involved in a lot of this here in Fairbanks. It was so different when we first moved here, and I had something to do with the Fairbanks Native Association, the Fiddlers, Kanaka, and the Fairbanks, just everything. But anyway, this fall, I mean, three months ago, someone called and someone said, how would you like to shake hands with Preston? I said, oh, sure. You know, people like to tease. Well, she said, I wanted to catch the 1 o'clock flight to Anchorage, go to Adam Northfield, and that's where we meet the Preston. And sure enough, I thought it was a joke at first, but I took a chance anyway. And when we were at Elmendorf, they even had a place a chair for me while I was to sit at the plate, landed right there, you know. And after he talked to the news miners and news reporters, he came right to me. I was the only Indian there, I guess. Anyway, this lady went right in front of me just as the president was coming, and he went right over her head and shook hands with me. That made me feel so proud, you know, because, as I said, I have been involved in a lot of things here in Fairbanks. I even wrote a book, the title of it is Mulatto and Indian Life on the Yukon. And it has to do with how the native people were before non-natives came. But if a person doesn't know much about native people, it's a very good book to learn something from. Anyway, when the talking about, I'm jumping from one thing to the other. When someone mentioned something about Denali song, I thought, gee, Denali song, how could I do that? Just right then and there, a song came to me, and it's not the right kind that I wanted, because the words is nothing. The words, I was brought up in my own Indian way, I can speak Indian. My grandparents have raised me, didn't know how to speak English, so all I learned a lot from them. But anyway, this is how that song goes. At first, I start with the verse, and then I said, Denali, say Denali, and then the verse. And then I said, you have taken your name back, you have taken your name back, Denali, Denali. The words to this, say Denali, say Denali. And the next part says. The next part is where I say, heard that you have taken your name back. Heard you have taken your name back. Say Denali, Denali. And then the last part was where I said, be happy for you know, Denali. So for a 96-year-old woman,
I just wonder if you could tell me how in the world Walter Harper got interested in joining the Army Air Corps. Did he see airplanes in Massachusetts? Whose idea was that?
Okay, so I'm actually glad you asked me, because there's an interesting, rather poignant part to that story that I didn't have time to mention. So quite sadly, when the call went out for men to join the service and serve the country in the Great War, Native Americans were not included in that call. And that hurt a lot of Alaska Natives, including Walter Harper. So that was the status of things, at least for some time. But then when Walter and Hudson Stuck were up in Barrow, they found out that Charlie Brower's two sons, who were half Inupiat, were serving in the war. And so that is, so Walter realized, oh, something must have changed. The policy must have changed. Native men must be welcome in the armed services. And he had, he was so adept at all things mechanical. And so he wasn't intending to go in the Army Air Corps to be a pilot. He was interested in learning to be an airplane mechanic at that time. That was what he was really interested in. And so although Stuck didn't want him to do that because he wanted him to go right into his education to become a physician, a medical missionary, he still at the same time was proud, and he thought he probably would make a really good airplane mechanic. So that was what the story was. Also, just a brief other note, it so happened that on the very day that Walter and Francis left Fort Yukon, they got word via the wire that came in every day to Fort Yukon at noon that the Kaiser was willing to sign an armistice. And so it was known at that very moment that the war was ending. And so Walter and Francis actually left that day unexpectedly, knowing that he wouldn't be going off to war, but that he could go to medical school immediately and they wouldn't have to be separated. But then, of course, that never played out either because they perished. But that was the story behind behind his decision to go into the Air Corps.
I'm just wondering if there's any writings or stories about Mr. Fredson's thoughts about when he was waiting for the expedition to come back. He just must have been felt like he's left there alone and maybe they are never coming back, but he had to keep waiting and waiting and just thinking, well, okay, I gotta be ready, but when are they coming back? Does anybody know anything about that?
And how old was he?
Well, there's debate about his age. Hudson Stuck said he was 14, but I think he might have been 16. I don't really know because we don't really know when he was born. But he was still a teenage boy. And everyone kept diaries. I think that was something that Hudson Stuck encouraged, that they all keep diaries. But my grandfather's diary, I believe, was lost in the 1967 flood. I know I never saw it. My mother talked about it. My aunts talked about it. But there was a woman, Miss Parmalee. So my grandfather ended up doing the same thing that Walter would have done. He was went to Mount Hermon, and then he went to Suwannee. I don't know where, medical school. Anyway, he told the story to Miss Parmalee, and Miss Parmalee was going to write a book. So I think they were in the archives at Suwannee, and so I read the chapter about him waiting. And so he said he would make the stewed apples. He had these dried apples, and so he would stew them, thinking they're going to come back, and then they wouldn't come back. So finally, he had to eat the apples before they went bad. So and it wasn't only the sugar that he saved; it was the milk supply he had. So, he was wondering, but I guess he could see. I'm not sure how. Could he? Is there a way? Did he have a? He could see part of the way that they were coming down, I think. But he had no. I don't know how he did it. I don't know. It was a little. He hunted, fed the dogs.
Just trivia. There's a little piece of the climb I just remembered. And I can't even remember the names. There was a family from Tananaw that followed them partway up the mountain. That heard the earth, you know, from Diane talking about the faith of people. There's a family in the Manchumina area that heard the archdeacon was in the area and they wanted to get the kid baptized. So they followed him X 1,000 feet up the mountain to get the kid baptized. 10,000 feet?
10,000 feet.
That's a serious baptism. I can't remember her name. I'm on the team. I don't know.
Do you remember the name of the person, the family who followed the Hudson Stuck up the mountain to get their child baptized? Yes, please.
I'm going to tell you a story about Mary Dick, about the mountain. Remember the time they were trying to change that mountain's name? Mary Dick was an elder from Canada, and she went to bed, and she says all of a sudden there were three well-dressed Indians flying down to her, telling her, sing this song. When she got up, she came down to me in my house, and she told me what happened, and she sang a song to me. And so, we believe that they still keep watch on what they have done. Those chiefs that came here at one time, they came. They're still watching out for what they did. They're watching out for that mountain. My people praise that mountain. People used to walk from Canada up to the mountain to go hunting sheep. Walking. They walk all the way from Canada up to the mountain. In springtime, they make their canoe and fold it back. There were mighty smart men. Maybe they didn't go to school and get an education, but they were very smart people. Everything, I tell stories to the kids at home and tell them stories about how I grew up and how the men thought ahead of time before things happened. They took care of it before it happened. They were very wonderful men and women, happy to. They were happy people. I grew up with people walking down the street. They meet each other, give each other a hug and laugh, tell each other stories and laugh. That is how I grew up in that little village down there. And I knew first came to Fairbanks, I went to her house, your mom's house. I'm a Joseph. My maiden name is Joseph. And I went to her house. And she used to tell me about her son. She told me about her son. That's how I knew him. But I knew all of her children, all of her sons and daughters. I just wanted to say wonderful things you can see. Wonderful people that have passed. And is wonderful people that was here ahead of us. I could name a lot of them. But I'm just grateful that I could be part of this. Thank you.
That was a beautiful song, by the way. Really appreciate you singing that for us. I just had a quick anecdote that I forgot to mention during my presentation. I was really able to bring this whole centennial climb full circle personally. About 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, I had a new girlfriend and we had decided to go to Juneau for the weekend along with the flights were cheap enough and we decided it'd be fun to just go on a quick adventure. As I was leaving the day before, I told mom about that. She's like, Walter Harper's buried there. I thought, I'm good. And she said, and you're gonna be there on the same weekend as their son. And I was like, oh wow. So it was kind of very serendipitous. And so I brought my journal that I kept the whole time on the Denali trip. And one of the things that I had done, right as we were getting onto McGonagall, from McGonagall Pass onto the Muldrow Glacier, I found the last couple flowers, wildflowers that were there, and I pressed them into my journal. I forgot about it. And so I brought my diary with me to Juneau, and we found his grave. And so on Summit Day, a little over a century later, I read to him my excerpt from my Summit Day, and then spread those flowers that were pressed in there from a gone past on his grave. So, it really helped bring it full circle for me. I thought it was really cool.
Thank you all once again for spending this evening with us and allowing to show us to tell you about our perspectives on Walter Harper and this history. It's really been a very special event. For anybody who's interested, I will be over here at the side with the books. If you'd like to purchase a book, I'm selling them at a discount from the publisher's price at $25, and I'll be happy to sign one for you. And remember, if you have a story that you'd like to share with the family, please contact Mike up here in front and write out your contact information and your story on the card for us. Thank you. Thank you.